listen for, and hopefully hear, and maybe possibly understand the words of Paul from the 6th chapter of Romans.
Well then, should we keep on sinning so that God can show us more and more of his wonderful grace? Of course not. Since we have died to sin, how can we continue to live in it? Or have you forgotten that when we were joined with Christ Jesus in baptism, we were joined to him in his death? For we died and were buried with Christ by baptism. And just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glorious power of the Father, now we also may live new lives. Since we have been united with him in his death, we will also be raised to life as he was. We know that our old sinful selves were crucified with Christ so that sin might lose its power in our lives. We are no longer slaves to sin, for when we died with Christ, we were set free from the power of sin. And since we died with Christ, we know we will also live with him. We are sure of this because Christ was raised from the dead, and he will never die again. Death no longer has any power over him. When he died once to break the power of sin. But now that he lives for the glory of God. So you also should consider yourselves to be dead to the power of sin and alive to God through Christ Jesus. Do not let sin control the way you live. Do not give in to sinful desires. Do not let any part of your body become an instrument of evil to serve sin. Instead, give yourselves completely to God, for you were dead, but now you have new life. So use your whole body as an instrument to do what is right for the glory of God. Sin is no longer your master, for you no longer live under the requirements of the law. Instead, you live under the freedom of God's grace.
Y'all got that, right? Okay. Then we can take a hike now. No, it's a... Paul is tough. His writing is difficult, and even if you understand all the words, it's not always easy to understand what it is he's talking about. The Apostle Paul's popularity over the years has been volatile. Paul's like the stock market. He has his ups and his downs in popularity. When I was in seminary, Paul was not a popular dude. I think unjustly, they thought that Paul was the author of all things patriarchal and male dominated in the church. And that just wasn't the fact. I think Paul's stock is a little higher now as people are beginning to understand him perhaps a little bit better. But most of the time I feel like Apostle Paul, in mainline churches anyway, has gotten a bum rap. Is that term still used anymore? It's kind of an old-fashioned term, a bum rap. Mostly because it's the most appalling people use him, or rather misuse him, and misuse his writing as a battering ram or a blunt object against people or against causes that they don't like. And as one might expect, the people being beat up tend to blame Paul for the abuse because the people who are beating them up said, "Oh, Paul says." When I was a Baptist about a million years ago, I watched how a few out-of-context quotes from Paul, or scholars would say later letters attributed to Paul, but not written by him, were misused to tell women that they couldn't be ordained, and to tell women that they could not teach men in a class, or they couldn't have a position of authority in the church, and how doing any of those things was a sin against God because Paul said so. Now, since I became a United Methodist, where that kind of thing doesn't happen, I was told, I've watched for 35 years how a few out-of-context quotes from Paul are misused to tell lesbian folk and gay folk and transgendered folk that they couldn't be ordained. They couldn't be married. They shouldn't be baptized. They actually shouldn't be at all, because their very being was a sin against God. Because
Paul said so.
So Paul has gotten, I believe, an undeservedly bad rap and a bad rep, because some of the meanest religious people have used the laziest of hermeneutics. That's a fancy word for biblical interpretation. You can drop that word at your next cocktail party and everyone will be very impressed. Hermeneutics. Okay. The meanest religious people have used the laziest hermeneutics to beat up the most vulnerable of God's children. And it doesn't matter if you do it when you're a Baptist or a Methodist. It's wrong. At the same time, because the S word that gets utilized and has been overutilized by these same mean, lazy religious people, the word, brace yourselves, are you holding on to something? The word sin has gotten a bad rap and a bad rep. I don't mean sin itself, it usually always has a bad rep and a bad rap, but the word sin has gotten a bad rep and a bad rap because mean, lazy, hypocritical religious people misuse the word so badly. The rest of us avoid it, especially in the mainline church. We avoid using the S word because if we use it, it makes us, to our ears, sound like we're being mean, lazy, hypocritical religious people. So we don't like. When was the last time you said the word sin out loud without being ironic? Ever? We don't want to sound like mean, lazy, hypocritical religious people because we're lovely, sincere people of faith always and everywhere, right? I know I am. Okay, maybe not. But sin is an important word for Paul, and I think it's, I may never use it casually, but it's an important concept in his writings, and I think it's an important concept in our Christian faith. I'm going to try to use a metaphor. You ready for a metaphor? When I was in college at the University of Illinois, after we got freedom from the dorms, a bunch of us got together and rented a whole, I think like a 12-room house, a 12-bedroom house. A whole bunch of us got together and rented out all the rooms, and one of my housemates was from Jamaica. He had grown up in the Chicago area, in Evanston, Illinois, so he had no Jamaican accent left, even though he was born there, except when he was talking to his grandmother, and then when he, 5 minutes of talking to his grandmother, and he sounded like Bob Marley. It was great, and that would wear off over the next hour or so, so we loved it when his grandma called. But it was really helpful for me. He was the first African-American man I had ever lived with, and here's a person who I can talk about his experiences of being black in America, and going out with him, witnessing the casual and the not so casual racism he had to deal with in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, and some of the other small realities of being black in America, things that I just never imagined. Like in the winter, he would buy lanolin cream by the gallon because his skin turned like gray in the winter, dry and flake off. He would just like slather himself with lanolin to keep himself brown instead of gray. There was a lot of pressure. He was in engineering, and he had a lot of there was a lot of pressure to kind of be IBM looking when we were in engineering. It didn't take with me, but. So there was a lot of pressure for the undergraduate engineers to look pretty spiffy all the time, and that meant shaving every day. And for him, it was a health issue for him to shave every day. And I had never heard of this, but when he shaved, close every day. He had very curly hair, and it would the hairs would turn back inward under the skin. They would turn and go back the other direction, and he would go out. There's a name for it. I had to look it up this week. Ready? Pseudofolliculitis barbae. And it would get infected and painful, and it was awful. I mean, trying to look like a white IBM executive was causing him a health issue, but there was pressure to do that. So he would suffer his way through and just have his skin was a wreck, because the hairs would turn in upon themselves, get infected, and it was awful. The Apostle Paul used the word sin to describe a particular way of being. That unpleasant metaphor I just used is not a bad one for. There's a Latin term that I have lost here. I wrote it down somewhere. It disappeared. I had this great Latin term. Wow, this is bad. Josh. Incurvitas en se?
Yeah,
curve back on yourself. Incurvitas en se, is that correct?
Yeah, on against yourself.
Thank you. St. Augustine and then later Martin Luther loved this Latin term. And they saw this as what it was to live in sin. They described it as a twisting, a curving of one into oneself, so that everything around you reflected back on how does this affect me. Nowadays, in a more Copernican universe, we might say that we are the center of our universe. And everything that happens, I interpret through the lens of how is this affecting me and my needs. It's a way of living in sin because it puts oneself, one's needs, one's hatreds, one's fears at the center of the universe. And not only do you worry about yourself being then... I interpret everything through that lens of how does everything affect me, but I then start expecting everybody else to see their reality through the lens of how it affects me. That seems reasonable, doesn't it? Shouldn't you all be seeing your reality and how it affects me and my life and my needs? I think that's only fair. That curving in upon oneself, whether it's an errant beard hair or our soul, becomes the opportunity for infection, for sin, for pain. Sin is a word we've given up because it means nothing now to say the word sin. Sin has been used to describe everything from playing cards on a Sunday because your grandma or great grandma was upset about it, to genocide. It's lost a bit of its specificity and power. Playing cards on a Sunday, your grandma said, it's a sin. A Ku Klux Klan march in Georgia, it's a sin. Except that there's fine people on both sides. A second helping of ice cream? It's a sin. Bragging about grabbing a woman by the... sin. Or locker room talk. Paul was more specific about sin. He never wrote anywhere that playing cards on a Sunday is a sin. So go to town. Or ice cream. Have the second helping of Ben and Jerry's. It's okay. Paul was more specific. He called the person who is a slave to sin, that way of life, he called it the old man, which is totally unfair to those of us who are old men. But it's also translated as the old Adam, or our fleshly self. Think of the person who's not only a slave to his most base hatreds and fears and appetites and addictions, but twists his universe in such a way that he works to make sure that everyone else is also a slave to his worst hatreds and fears and appetites and addictions. That all thoughts and words and actions become tools to feed the hatreds and fears and appetites and addictions. Where truth and lies are but means to an end, and people are simply tools to achieve a goal. That is the old Adam. That is the old man. That is the life turned, curved in upon itself. Because sin has been used so badly and for such silly things, we often use sin as something that's actually kind of attractive. Ooh, I was at a restaurant where people were talking about, the waiter was talking about the dessert bar. And every time he finished describing something, and these were women, so I'm going to use that for you, but they were like, "Ooh, that's so sinful." And he described the next thing, "Oh, that's so sinful." It's like, no, it's not. It's dessert. Enjoy it, for crying out loud. But sinful meant somehow naughtily enjoyable. That's not what Paul's talking about. Paul's not talking about flourless chocolate cake. He's not talking about wearing extra tall high heels to the dance. He's not talking about any of the stuff that your grandma was appalled by when you did it. He's talking about a life that is curved in upon itself, where it can become infected and painful for you and for everyone else around you. That is what Paul is talking about when he says, my old man, my old Adam, my sinful self has been crucified with Christ. Paul lived in a culture where slavery was the woof. I don't know my weaving here. Woof and warp? Warp and the two? It doesn't mean anything. Never mind. Slavery was an inherent part of the economy and social culture. So there was assumption that everyone has to be a slave to someone or something. And he says, because we have been buried with Christ, we've been crucified with Christ, we have been raised with Christ, we now are no longer slaves to our old fleshly Adam selves. You're going to be a slave to someone. Who was our good friend, great folk singer? You're going to have to serve somebody. Bob Dylan, thank you. You're going to have to serve somebody. Paul would interpret that. You're going to have to, the same word, serve and slave is doulos in Greek. You're going to have to serve somebody. You're going to have to be a slave to somebody. For Paul, you can be a slave to yourself, to your own worst fears, hatreds, prejudices. You can be turned in, curved in upon yourself, or you can be a slave to God. You can be a servant of God, a role that is liberating, other-centered, and is making a new life of dignity, of resurrection, of life, capital L, life. Paul talks about our being a new creation. When we make a decision to say yes to discipleship, to say yes to Christ, we say no to the old Adam, the old fleshly self, and we say yes to Christ. We are a new creation. Not just we've done a little self-improvement. Not that we, trimmed the bushes, painted the trim in the office, put a new sign up out front, We are a new creation. Whom God is especially fond of. Most of my daily miseries over the course of the day, and most of my daily miseries are not big things. Most of my walking days, I am not being overly burdened by the big structural sins because I'm a person of privilege. I'm white, I'm heterosexual, I'm male, I'm college educated, I'm middle class. The world's pretty kind to me. I'm not walking around weighed down by that. But I still find myself cranky at the end of the day. And most of the stuff that makes me a little bit cranky, most of my little daily miseries are caused by other people not curving themselves around toward me the way I would like, right? That person isn't treating me the way I think I deserve to be. It gets my ego in a bunch. I curve in on myself, and I'm cranky. The woman who cut me off in traffic, if I'm honest, she didn't see me, right? Or she's in a hurry. Or she's just not thinking very much. Or fine, she's a jerk. That's fine. But I take it as though that woman who cut me off in traffic did not have me at the center of her universe. What's the matter with her? That phone scam caller calling me 12 times today, wanting to help me fix the virus on my Windows computer, or offering to give me a lower percentage rate on my credit card, or a great deal on solar power. Are there any new ones? Have people gotten? I seem to get those three all the time. Any? Medicare. Oh, I haven't gotten that one yet.
You're very lucky.
Ah, okay.
Oh, the one that there's an arrest warrant out for you.
There's a what?
There's an arrest warrant out for you.
Oh, yes, yes, the IRS wants to. That's right. Now, as annoying as those things are, and they are, the poor schlep on the other, or schmuck rather, on the other end of the line is just following a script, committing a crime, yes. He's a scam artist, he's horrible, all those things, absolutely. But guess what? I'm not the center of his universe. I don't need to get personally offended. I can just hang up. But I get upset because he's not viewing me as the person whose wants and whims and needs are the most important thing in the world. In fact, it's his, and that gets me really upset. I get personally offended because he wants to take advantage of me. I'm like, I'm not that important to him. But I can get upset. I get mad because he's not curving his own crooked little world to accommodate me and my ego and my needs. Paul is pretty hardcore. And it's especially hardcore for those of us who are 21st century Christians because we have an entire economic system that is based on telling me every day that I am the most important person in the universe. And my needs and wants are the most important in the universe. And I'll be even happier if I satisfy those and they happen to have something to sell me that'll make me much, much happier. Remember the old hair color commercial back in the old days? Was it L'Oreal? You're worth it. Snickers used to sell that. You deserve it. That one's true. That one's true, yes. If you have a teenage daughter and you watch this insanely confident, competent 11-year-old bring home her first Vogue magazine and start comparing herself to the pictures in that magazine. And they do this brilliant double standard of telling you how important and wonderful and perfect you are, except that you don't look like these airbrushed supermodels. So really what happens when she closes that thing up is she's feeling completely and utterly inadequate. But here, we'll sell you an $80 half-ounce vial of a magic serum that will take 20 years off your skin, or fix your acne, or smooth out your cellulite, help you lose 190 pounds, get a beautiful boyfriend, a really sweet car, and everything will be good. Paul says that's what we put up on the cross. And our resurrection comes with being raised with Jesus, who calls each of us beloved children, just as we are. We don't have to lose 100 pounds. We don't have to have perfect skin. We just have to be. Saying no to the old Adam and saying yes to Christ is pretty hardcore. The no means we're saying no to some things that are culture values, and saying yes is an invitation to go deeper where our culture doesn't care about. The difference between the yes and the no is the difference between journeying toward a goal or wandering around without a map. Even in the midst of our troubles, Jesus has assured his disciples that God is the one whose eye is on the sparrow, who's counted the very hairs on your head, which is much easier for a lot of us than it used to be. That not a tear would be shed that God would not wipe away, that not a joy would be felt that God would not dance to. Christ calls us to say yes to that kind of amazing grace. Christ also calls us to take up a cross. And as Paul assures us in this scary little letter, if we've been united with Christ in a death like Christ, we will certainly be united with Christ in a resurrection like Christ. And such is the cost and the joy of saying yes to discipleship. Barbara Brown Taylor, who we're reading on Monday nights, writes that while it may send a shiver down our spines, there is good news here for those with the nerve to hear it. The gospel is not a flashlight, but a fire. It can warm and it can burn. The gospel is not a table knife, but a sword. It can set free and it can divide. The gospel is not pablum. It is powerful stuff. Powerful enough to challenge the most sacred human ties. But as frightening as it is, it's not finally to be feared. It is to be loved. For ultimately, for Jesus and for Paul, that is the gospel, love. And that is authentic discipleship, love. Someone asked the Methodist theologian Albert Outler, the guy who came up with the term quadrilateral, what he had learned over a lifetime. And he responded, early in my life, I would tell people, you've got to love, you've got to love. Now I have grown to realize that You get to love. You get to love. That's the point. We don't have to give up family and friends. We don't have to give up sunsets. I would add, you don't have to give up flourless chocolate cake or Ben and Jerry's. All those favorite things, all those important things, because we love God, it's entirely the other way around. Because we love God, we can love those important things and those silly favorite things even more. Our lives do not become a giant list of don'ts and thou shalt nots when we become Christian. Rather, our lives become more real, more full, more worth living. So I invite you all to say yes to authentic discipleship. I invite you all to say yes to Jesus. I invite you to say yes to Paul. Mostly I want you to say yes to love. Amen.